KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
A misuse of talent and forces, so to actually turn that toward American citizens is problematic.
This hour, perspective from a retired Marine Corps general on President Trump's decision to send Marines to Los Angeles.
It's Tuesday, June 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Every Tuesday, protesters gather outside the CDC in Atlanta to rally against cuts to public health funding.
I think that we had a good process, and I don't know why we would walk away from that now.
Meanwhile, national parks are bracing for record crowds and federal budget cuts this summer.
Also, the former president of Brazil testifies in a trial about an alleged plot to hang on to power.
And one of the earliest paintings by J.M.W. Turner has been rediscovered.
Generally speaking, when someone comes in and says, I think I might have a Turner, the one sort of immediate reaction is to be a little bit skeptical.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer.
This is the Los Angeles Police Department. Get off of the street and onto the sidewalk.
Authorities in Los Angeles ordering demonstrators to stop blocking thoroughfares there as protests against President Trump's immigration policies entered a fifth day. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass announced a curfew that takes effect tonight for a limited time.
The curfew will be in place tonight from 8 p.m. until 6 a.m.
There are reports tonight some of the nearly 4,000 National Guard troops called up by the administration have begun protecting immigration agents as they make arrests in the country's second largest city. California Governor Gavin Newsom sought an immediate restraining order regarding the Guard deployment and requests for 700 Marines. A U.S. District Court judge declined to issue that today but did call for a hearing on Thursday. A Democratic House lawmaker from New Jersey has been indicted on charges of, quote, forcibly impeding immigration officers at a New Jersey detention facility. The indictment of 38-year-old Congresswoman LaMonica McIver was announced today by acting U.S. Attorney for the state, Alina Haba. The two assault charges stemming from a May 9th visit to a Newark detention center. McIver denied the allegation, calling the charges, quote, a brazen attempt at political intimidation. Several U.S. allies have imposed sanctions on two Israeli officials, accusing them of inciting violence against Palestinians. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is criticizing the sanctions, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary Rubio is condemning the U.K., Canada, Norway, New Zealand, and Australia for their sanctions on two sitting members of the Israeli cabinet, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Rubio says in a statement that these sanctions do not advance U.S. efforts to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. The British government says its sanctions are meant to pressure the Israeli government to stop expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank. It accuses the two far-right cabinet members of inciting, quote, extremist violence and serious abuses of Palestinian human rights. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
27 states and the District of Columbia have filed a lawsuit against saliva-based DNA kit company 23andMe. To stop the sale of its genetic data without customer approval. Colorado Public Radio's Cara DeMayer reports the suit potentially involves the personal data of more than 15 million people.
23andMe declared bankruptcy back in March and said the company would sell the genetic data collected from customers who took their popular at-home DNA test. Concerns were raised after the biotech company Regeneron Pharmaceuticals announced its plan to buy 23andMe's data for $256 million. The company is vowing to comply with the privacy policies users have already agreed to. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser says genetic and health information cannot be sold off like
this. Is NPR. When the Trump administration likes to show it's attracting more foreign investment to the U.S., one provision of the administration's so-called Big Beautiful Bill could put a damper on that. The House-passed version of the measure includes a provision that would allow the federal government to impose taxes on foreign-parented companies and investors from countries deemed to charge unfair taxes on U.S. firms. New analysis has estimated the provision could cost the U.S. as much as $55 billion annually over 10 years and cost the country 360,000 jobs. During hurricanes and wildfires, people in harm's way receive evacuation alerts from their mobile providers, and the Federal Communications Commission plan to update those alerts to include multiple languages. NPR's Nate Perez reports that has not happened.
The FCC was supposed to begin updating its emergency alert system in multiple languages in January. but it has yet to do that. The update included the 13 most commonly spoken languages in the U.S., such as Korean and Arabic. Around 12,000 Asian Americans needed language assistance during the L.A. wildfires earlier this year. UCLA professor Paul Ong says having multilingual emergency alerts could have helped.
Among Asian Americans, we find literally dozens of languages spoken. And that speaks to the cultural diversity of this population.
The FCC and the White House did not respond to multiple emails from NPR requesting comment. Nate Perez, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices fell today, oil down 31 cents a barrel to $64.98 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Hundreds of active duty U.S. Marines have now arrived right here in the greater Los Angeles area. President Trump ordered them to mobilize in a, quote, support role to protect federal property and personnel amid protests over ICE immigration raids.
Now, this is controversial. It is raising legal questions to do with the deployment of active duty military on U.S. soil and over the objections of state and local leaders. But we wanted to take a moment to consider what this looks like through the eyes of the 700 or so Marines tasked with the mission. That is something we're going to talk through now with retired Marine Lieutenant General Walter Gaskin. He served decades in the Marine Corps, working as acting chairman of the NATO Military Committee, deploying to Iraq, and serving as commanding general, 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. General Gaskin, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your first thought when you heard Marines were being deployed to LA?
A misuse of talent and forces, even though I hear a lot about the lack of training. The training isn't the issue. They are trained to do that. But what comes into is they're trained killers and separation of a very hostile rules of engagement. So to actually turn that toward American citizens is problematic.
Let me jump in. Okay, so you just said this, in your view, is a misuse of talent and forces. And say more about the issue of trained killers. They have not been ordered, I will say. They are in LA. They have not been deployed to specific places. We don't know exactly what they're going to be doing. But the idea, as I say, is that they will be protecting federal buildings, federal property, federal personnel. Why is that so problematic?
Because you can't turn it off. A mission to restore peace and protect property may require the use of deadly force. That use of deadly force against American citizens is very problematic. In addition to that, they do not have posse comitatus, the ability to arrest and detain, especially under the Title 10 provision, which is train and equip forces to engage, close with, and destroy the enemy.
I just want to push you on this when you say you can't turn it off. The commandant of the Marine Corps, this is General Eric Smith, he was just asked some of the questions I'm asking you, and he's saying, look, they're not going to have arrest authority. They are only there to protect federal property, federal personnel. They are trained for crowd control.
That's exactly right. But remember the follow-up on that statement, and as I know General Smith very well, he was once one of my company commanders and has been placed in that type of situation when we were defending the embassy in Liberia. When I say you can't turn it off, if you're there to protect something, what if the crowd pushes you? What if the crowd starts throwing bricks? Molotov cocktails. It becomes a deadly situation in that defense. That's what I mean. You can't turn it off once you have engaged it.
I did want to ask about the troop numbers that are in play here. We're looking at 4,000 National Guard, 700 Marines for a situation that California and LA officials say local law enforcement can handle. Is that overkill?
Well, it is extreme overkill. For example, if you look at the size of the police force there in Los Angeles, plus the sheriff department, plus the National Guard, you know, for a what was originally about 400 disturbance, and you will always, I have never seen an environment where you didn't have agitators. And so if the de-escalation has not happened, it won't until there are casualties. And we've got too many examples of that type of thing in our history, just by using National Guard and the police force, let alone adding active duty Title 10 soldiers and Marines to do that.
Do you see issues with chain of command in this situation?
I do. I would not want to be in the commandant position or that division commander or that regimental commander or that battalion commander who has to prepare these folks for combat, because, like I said, there is no halfway in between, either or. When ordered to do, they have to execute. That's why we train and we put restraint on and rules of engagement, so that they understand if ordered to do this, this is because this is requirement, not some political whim or something that someone wants to do politically to prove a point.
What guidance would you give a Marine who came to you with questions about this mission?
Same thing that we always do. Ours is not to reason why, but to do or die. And that's what we are trained to do. And so they have to follow orders. That's why the pressure becomes on the leadership. And as I started out by saying, the misuse of a capability.
General Gaskin, thank you.
Thank you.
That's retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Walter Gaskin.
Cowboy boots and fishnets might not feel like a natural pairing, but at one dance party, that is pretty much the uniform. NPR's Margaret Serino stopped by a weekly queer line dancing night in New York City to talk to the partygoers.
Heels, toes, right, heel, left, heel, stop.
Up on stage at the Brooklyn Monarch, an instructor is running through the steps for a line dance.
Don't stop, give it all you got. Yeah.
What got these 300 people out on a Tuesday night is Stud Country, a weekly queer line dancing party. It started in Los Angeles in 2018 and was so popular, it spread to cities across the United States.
Is this anyone's first stud?
The crowd is a sea of fishnets, leather boots, pink cowboy hats, glittering bikini tops. Some folks are sporting black tank tops with the word stud bedazzled in rhinestones. The first lesson ends, and a group peels off from the dance floor and heads to the courtyard out back to give their legs a rest. Taryn Kudka is there with their friend Emily Harms. It's their first time at Stud Country.
Have you line danced before?
No. I've been wanting to do this for quite a while. I just heard it's a lot of fun.
After the first dance, I was like, oh, we're coming back.
For Harms and a lot of others here tonight, this weekly dance is a rare chance to feel connected with other queer people.
We need queer community constantly. Especially now, continuously, we need to keep being together and having joy. This is beautiful.
The night's winding down and people start making their exits. But a core group of veterans linger for the final hour called the Power Hour. It's the sweatiest point of the evening with the most difficult dances. One of those remaining is Kitty Horblett. She says stud country is vital.
Very much like church. We're all in the same place at the same time each week. Mm-hmm. We're really just all here to like love on ourselves, love on each other. Like, I think that's what's important.
For NPR News, I'm Margaret Serino in New York.
Were you to consult the National Gallery in London, you would learn that J.M.W. Turner, known as William Turner, is, quote, perhaps the best-loved English romantic artist. He is something of a national icon, so a discovery of a Turner painting is, well, huge news in the British art world.
Generally speaking, when someone comes in and says, I think I might have a Turner, one sort of immediate reaction is to be a little bit skeptical on the basis that, you know, it sort of sounds too good to be true.
Julian Gascoigne is senior director at Sotheby's in London, and Sotheby's has announced the auction of a painting that was forgotten in a private collection for more than 150 years, then restored.
In that process, when they were taking off these layers of old varnish, the restorer found a signature which says W. Turner.
It's called The Rising Squall, and it was Turner's first oil painting to be exhibited. He was a teenager, still working out his own style.
I mean, he's a 17-year-old artist when he paints this picture, so it's very much sort of indebted to the classical traditions and sort of other artists working at this time.
We asked Julian Gascoigne to paint us a picture of the painted picture. He told us it's a dramatic scene, a cluster of buildings and fishing boats on a rocky coastline with a stormy sky approaching.
And a sort of glimmer of light coming through the middle of the sky, which illuminates the whole scene.
Much later, William Turner would become known for his use of light in landscapes and seascapes that verged on the impressionistic, even avant-garde.
The Rising Squall is an early Turner, but here's the real head Turner. When it first changed hands recently, it sold for the equivalent of $506. When it's going to be auctioned on July 2nd, Sotheby's thinks it could go for around $300,000 to $400,000.
Which, also based on other recent Turner discoveries, that might turn out to be a conservative estimate. The number of Americans claiming Social Security benefits has jumped 17% this year, and one group filing at much higher rates than before, 62-year-olds. That is the youngest age you can file for retirement benefits, even though filing that young could have a long-term impact on their finances. We look at what's behind the rush for retirement benefits. You can tune in tomorrow to All Things Considered. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza by Israeli strikes over these past 20 months of war, a war which began with a deadly Hamas attack on Israel. Well, Gaza now lies in ruins. The leaders of Hamas have been killed, and the group, which still holds some Israeli hostages, has been vastly degraded. Now, Israel is using another tactic in the war, arming a new militia in Gaza. NPR's Aya Betraoui in Dubai reports on the group and its origins.
The biggest looting of UN aid anywhere ever happened in southern Gaza last November. Here's UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric speaking to reporters about it then.
You and I have been in these briefings for a few years. I don't ever recall any of us talking about a convoy of 109 trucks run by the UN being looted.
The looters took all the food, even the fuel and tires from the trucks. This brazen attack happened in an area of Gaza under Israeli military control near the border with Israel. It was one of many lootings that Palestinians say was carried out by gangs that became known as Abu Shabab, a group named after one of its leaders, Yasser Abu Shabab, a man Israel is now arming as a militia leader. Ahmed Amawi is an aid coordinator in Gaza. He says Abu Shabab's looting of UN aid last year caused widespread hunger.
We know very well Yasser Abu Shabab. He is a criminal, a fugitive, wanted for numerous drug-related charges. Socially, he is isolated and widely known throughout the Palestinian community as an untrustworthy and mentally unstable individual.
Abu Shabab was in jail in Gaza when the war started back in 2023 for murder and drug smuggling. Hamas say he was freed when they opened the prisons to spare people from Israeli airstrikes all around. What was suspected in Gaza was that Abu Shabab's looters were supported by Israel, as their looting kicked the legs out from under the UN aid system, which Israel alleges Hamas was benefiting from. Last week, Israel's support for Abu Shabab was made explicit when opposition politician Avigdor Lieberman said this on Israeli public radio. He said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is constantly trying to build something to counter something else. He says for years Netanyahu allowed Hamas to receive funding for its government to undermine the rival Palestinian Authority. And he says we saw how that ended. He says Netanyahu is now providing weapons to fighters from the extremist Islamic State group to counter Hamas in Gaza. Netanyahu responded to Lieberman by confirming Israel is backing tribes in Gaza. He says Israel has, quote, activated clans that oppose Hamas, and says what's wrong with that, before saying it's only good. But even far-right ministers in his government say they do not support this idea, and neither do Palestinians like Ahmed Fouad al-Khatib. He's a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council who's had family killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. He's also opposed to Hamas in power, but says any alternative must have clear oversight by a Palestinian political body in order to govern with legitimacy, unlike Yasser Abu Shabab.
He creates this illusion that Gazans who are anti-Hamas are all somehow affiliated with the IDF, with the Israeli military. So that's what's dangerous about him.
Abu Shabab, meanwhile, is now rebranding itself as protectors of aid, with photos of them securing routes for a new Israeli plan that restricts how food is distributed in Gaza. Health officials say at least 150 people have been killed by Israeli soldiers trying to reach these sites run by American contractors. Israel says troops have fired warning shots. On a new Facebook page, Abu Shabab describes itself as a counter-terror group and labels itself the Popular Forces.
ندعو أبناء وعائلات المنطقة الشرقية لرفح
In one of their videos, they call residents of southeast Gaza who've been forcibly displaced by the military to return, saying it's safe. It shows a family receiving food aid from them and empty tents they've erected. The groups also posted photos brandishing what analysts say appear to be Hamas rifles seized by Israel. They're donning helmets, camo, and tactical vests, and they have an insignia of an eagle eating a snake. But Hamas, too, has videos. In this, Hamas fighters scope out some of Abu Shabab's men, described as Zionist collaborators in South Gaza's Rafah. Several are then killed with an improvised explosive. And Abu Shabab this week, for the first time in the war, say they ambushed a group of Hamas security forces who target looters and collaborators in southern Gaza. Hamas say the Israeli military then struck their fighters to provide cover for Abu Shabab to flee. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza City and Ahmed Abu Hamda in Cairo.
National parks like Yellowstone and the Great Smoky Mountains are bracing for record crowds again this summer, just as President Trump is trying to cut more than $1 billion from the Park Service budget. The administration says the tourist experience will not be affected, but as NPR's Kirk Sigler reports, conservationists and lawmakers tell a different story.
The headlines focus on the fallout from President Trump's DOGE staffing cuts, leading to visitor center closures, bathrooms going uncleaned. But national park advocates say the crisis is way bigger. Trump's proposed big, beautiful budget bill for the current fiscal year would rescind more than $250 million in funding that pays for rangers, emergency responders, and scientists. And next year, he wants to cut $1.2 billion more. Kristen Brangle is vice president of the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association.
This is just a bad decision from the administration to put it in the president's budget and think the American public doesn't want to protect our national park system anymore.
An analysis by her group found that in order to cut that much out of the agency's operating budget, the president would need to sell off 350 national park sites. Not the 63 official national parks, but the smaller places, like, say, Martin Luther King National Historic Park in Atlanta or California's John Muir National Historic Site.
You think President Trump always wants to do these overtures toward American legacy. And so it's very, very strange and doesn't really jive with what we saw last time around.
In his first term, Trump signed a bill adding money for parks. This time he wants to transfer some of these smaller sites to state ownership. But it's unclear states are interested. For instance, a Utah parks official confirmed to NPR in an email there are no plans to manage anything but state parks. The Department of the Interior did not respond to an interview request, but Interior Secretary Doug Burgum recently told a Senate committee he's trying to cut what he considers unnecessary bureaucracy and hire more people to actually work in national parks.
Whether they're driving a snowplow in the wintertime or whether they're working with his interpreter in the summertime or whether we're doing trail work, if they're firefighting, I want more of that. I want less overhead.
There was bipartisan backlash, including from the chair of Senate Appropriations, Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski.
When we see a skinny budget that proposes to cut $1.2 billion or 35% from Park Service, it's hard to square it with the claims that DOI is focused on fostering the American economy.
Murkowski says national parks generate billions for the U.S. economy. The fate of Trump's plans to dramatically cut funding from America's national parks now rests with the Senate. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has mobilized the National Guard and the Marines following days of protests against immigration raids in Los Angeles, despite objections from California's governor. We'll speak with an official from the Department of Homeland Security about why the Trump administration says a military presence is necessary to restore order. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, Pakistan battle-tested Chinese weapons during its most recent conflict with India.
By the time we got into this round of conflict, Pakistan's weaponry, 72 to 80%, has been from China.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The mayor of Los Angeles has enacted a curfew tonight for parts of the downtown area. That's where protesters against President Trump's immigration raids have been gathering for a fifth day in a row. Trump says National Guard troops will remain despite a lawsuit and opposition from city officials. Here's NPR's Franco Ordonez.
Speaking at the White House, President Trump says that without the deployment of the National Guard, the ongoing protests in Los Angeles would be out of control.
If we didn't send out the National Guard, and last night we gave them a little additional help, you would have, Los Angeles would be burning right now.
Trump ordered thousands of National Guard troops to Los Angeles to address anti-immigration enforcement protests without the consent of California's Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom. Trump said he spoke to Newsom recently and said he was an incompetent leader. Trump would not say how long the National Guard would remain in Los Angeles, only that they'll stay until there's, quote, no danger. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Russia has unleashed another major drone strike against Ukraine. NPR's Greg Myrie has more.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia fired more than 300 drones as well as a smaller number of missiles overnight. He called it one of the heaviest assaults yet on the capital, Kyiv. The president urged the U.S. and Europe to respond not with silence, but with concrete action. The southern coastal city of Odessa was also hard hit, including the strike on a maternity hospital that injured more than a dozen people. Ukraine carried out a surprise drone strike that destroyed Russian warplanes on June 1st. Since then, Russia has staged nighttime attacks with upwards of 300 and even 400 drones, the most intensive of the war so far. Greg Myrie, NPR News.
In New York City, the second alleged sex trafficking victim of Sean Diddy Combs returned to the witness stand today as the hip-hop mogul's defense attorneys began their cross-examination of the witness. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports, and a warning here, this contains descriptions of sex.
For several days, the woman identified only as Jane told the court about her relationship with Combs from 2021 until 2024. She testified that Combs repeatedly promised quality time together, but would then pressure her into sex with male prostitutes. In her cross-examination, defense attorney Tenny Garagos repeatedly asked Jane to read explicit text messages she sent to Combs describing fantasies about multiple men. Jane told the court that she sent these messages because she knew it was what Combs wanted to hear, but she said she did not want to act on them and was traumatized by the encounters Combs pressured her to perform in. Jane's cross-examination will continue when court is back in session. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
Uncertainty about the future of the economy has consumers pulling back on their spending. Forecasters at Morgan Stanley are warning that lower-income families may have to dial back their spending on fast food. Analysts downgrading their price target for McDonald's, saying the burger chain may not be insulated from those higher costs. On Wall Street, stocks finish modestly higher today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. When President Trump made his push to shrink the federal workforce, more than 1,000 employees at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, lost their jobs. Well, now every Tuesday, people protest the firings at the agency's headquarters in Atlanta. Today, they were raising the alarm over the removal of all 17 members from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. That's ACIP for short. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said he would like a clean sweep. Sophie Gratis with Georgia Public Broadcasting was at today's protest. She is here with us now. Hey, Sophie.
Hi.
Hey, so I gather it was public health workers, former and current, at this protest. You were talking to them. What did you hear about this move by RFK Jr. to dissolve the panel?
Yeah, so after dealing with some heavy rain that was on and off all afternoon, there ended up being several dozen people out in front of the CDC campus today. And many of them truly expressed despair over the complete overhaul of the advisory committee. I heard from Amelia Pasalic, who was laid off during the reduction in force earlier this year. And She called the move to dismantle the committee a real shame.
I came to CDC to work because I believe in science, because I believe in saving people's lives. And one of the things that makes science powerful is that it's not something that somebody dictates.
Others that I talked to called the move a last straw in what has to them felt like a really overwhelming couple of months.
And I want to get into what specific issues they have with the gutting of this panel. This is the panel, by the way, that makes recommendations to the CDC on what vaccines people should get, when they should get them. What else were people saying?
They said that they hold the committee in high regard and that it was made up of scientists really at the top of their field. So that included pediatricians, immunologists, epidemiologists, and others. Kathy Cavallaro is a retired CDC worker, and she said that she worked for over 20 years helping other countries create similar vaccine advisory committees to what the U.S. had.
The U.S. committee has been a model for those committees throughout the world, and it is simply embarrassing and heartbreaking to see what's happening.
So she doesn't think that it's a model anymore at this point, and she's worried that the next committee is going to be made up of people who don't trust the science behind vaccines or don't support vaccination efforts overall.
And then give us a little bit of a fuller picture of these protests. I did not realize that people were showing up in front of the CDC every week. What else have people been calling for?
Yeah, often outside every week are retirees from the CDC, but the group overall that includes former employees and current ones now, they want action against the cuts being made to the CDC and to other health agencies. So many of them are actively involved in or following ongoing court cases that are aiming to reverse layoffs across federal agencies. But a lot of these folks are also asking for transparency. Some current and former CDC workers say that information has been really limited about whether certain research grants will be canceled or not, and whether there are going to be more layoffs. Staffs, they were actually hoping to address those concerns today, and there was supposed to be the first all-hands staff meeting since President Trump took office. But that meeting was canceled last minute and will be rescheduled soon. That's according to an internal email that a current CDC employee showed me, and it was sent out to staff from CDC Chief of Staff Matt Bazzelli. As far as they know, he's been in charge since there's been no new director confirmed to the CDC yet.
And Sophie, before we let you go, I just want to follow up. You stressed that it's current employees who are joining, who you were talking to at the protest today, along with former. I gather that is new for current employees to be joining the protests?
It is. It's out of the norm because a lot of current employees are worried about retribution. Retired and fired workers don't have to worry about that as much. And most of them didn't want to speak on the record, but some did stand on what organizers dubbed a soapbox. It was really a ladder. But they talked about what they describe as HHS Secretary's support of misinformation and overall dismantling of public health institutions. They also really want the public to know what they've lost with all of these terminations. They were holding up signs that read "The CDC saves lives," other signs that highlight the CDC's ongoing work in vaccine education, oral health, anti-smoking initiatives, and all of that work has been interrupted with these mass layoffs.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you.
Sophie Gratis with Georgia Public Broadcasting.
And now to Brazil, where former President Jair Bolsonaro took the stand today in a landmark Supreme Court trial. Bolsonaro and seven former aides are being tried for their parts in an alleged plan to cling to power after Bolsonaro lost the 2022 presidential election. It's the first time in Brazilian history that a former head of state is being tried for attempting to overthrow the government. Julia Carneiro reports from Rio de Janeiro.
It's a defining moment for Brazil, a former president on trial for plotting a coup with the nation watching live. Former President Jair Bolsonaro took to the stand in a trial gripping a country still haunted by two decades of military rule. Bolsonaro, 70, testified Tuesday before Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, one of the figures he's accused of targeting in the alleged coup plan. The populist far-right former leader is charged with trying to overturn his defeat to leftist Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in the 2022 election.
É verdadeira a acusação que lhe é feita.
From the outset, Bolsonaro denied all charges. The Trump ally faces six counts, including leading a criminal organization and the violent abolition of the democratic rule of law. Prosecutors said the plot involved plans to assassinate then-president-elect Lula da Silva, his vice president, and Justice Moraes. This week, all eight defendants, including Bolsonaro, are testifying. One of them, Lieutenant Colonel Mauro Cid, has turned state's witness. This is a historic moment, says journalist Carolina Brígido, who specializes in Brazil's judiciary and has been following the trial in the capital, Brasília. But to maintain his political clout, Brígido says, Bolsonaro must deny any wrongdoing and stick to his narrative of being targeted by the courts. This was Brasília 2 years ago. Bolsonaro supporters stormed the Supreme Court and other government buildings on January 8 in scenes echoing the January 6 Capitol riot in Washington. Investigators say the January 8 attacks were part of a broader coup plot that included efforts to cast doubt on Brazil's voting system and suggest the election was rigged. Central to the plan was the so-called Minuta do Golpe, a draft of a bill that would have paved the way for blocking Lula from taking office. In court this week, Bolsonaro's former aide and whistleblower, Lieutenant Colonel Mauro Cid, says the ex-president read and edited the draft. Bolsonaro, however, denied this. I was always on the side of the Constitution, he told the court. I deny any talk of drafting a bill incompatible with the Constitution. Bolsonaro is already barred from running for office until 2030. But despite all this, he remains a powerful political force. Bruna Santos of the Brazil Institute says the real question is how he'll spin the trial to his advantage.
It's all for us to see how this trial will energize his base, how this trial is going to turn or not into a political event, and how this may define the future of the right in the elections in 2026.
The trial is due to end on Friday. A verdict could still take several months. If found guilty, Bolsonaro could face up to 40 years in prison. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Orville Peck is a country music singer who is known for keeping some secrets. Orville Peck is actually a stage name, and he has always performed in a mask. That is, until now, when he's baring his face for the first time as the MC in Cabaret on Broadway.
I've actually been able to accomplish a lot of my dreams, which is incredible to say, but this one in particular, playing the MC in Cabaret on Broadway, that exact specific scenario has been a lifelong dream.
On this week's Wildcard, Orville Peck let the mask down a little more with host Rachel Martin. He talked about hitting pause on his career to get sober.
What do you feel like you're constantly chasing?
I think I was chasing acceptance my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But I have really worked on not needing to chase that any longer.
Yeah.
And I think that comes with probably age. You know, I think it comes with the fact that I've pretty successfully killed all my imposter syndrome at this point.
Well, man.
I think Broadway was like the last stab. and also,
you made
you know,
it,
like,
Orville Peck.
No, literally. But also, you know, like I got sober a couple of years ago. Mm. There's like a lot of things in my life that I have worked on over the last 2 or 3 years, where I'm just really happy with myself.
Yeah. Congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
Can you tell me how you came to that realization that you just, it's hard after a lifetime of a habit.
Oh yeah.
To say, I'm going to do something different today.
No, absolutely. You know, it was, just being in the industry I'm in, obviously drinking is, and drugs and things are just, it's very normalized and it's a part of nightlife. It's a part of, you know, like I don't think I ever played a show in my life without at least a sip of beer or whatever, you know, like, and so it's just part of it. So there was that normalization. And then, you know, the big moments for me sort of were over a few years. I was in a really terrible relationship that was, you know, pretty abusive and very difficult. And that is when I really ramped up my drinking to cope with that. Pandemic hit. Kind of amplified that situation and amplified my drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then cut to a couple of years go by. And then, you know, I had like a pretty definitive moment where I had to basically lose my career for a moment while I went and got help and sober. And it was just a very defining moment where I was like, man, like this is taking everything I love away from my life. And so for me, I never feel tempted to drink or to relapse personally because I'm so grateful for the things I have in my life. And I know that for me, drinking takes that away from me.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. You can see Orville Peck on Broadway now as the MC in Cabaret.
Back on the run, back to the blue. Winning is fun, losing is too. Roses are falling, roses from falling.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Over the past decade and a half, states with permissive firearm laws saw a rise in gun-related deaths in kids. That's according to a new study published in JAMA Pediatrics. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
Since 2020, guns have become the leading cause of death in children and teens in the United States, killing more kids every year than car accidents. The rise in these deaths began shortly after a landmark 2010 Supreme Court case that led many states to change their gun laws.
After 2010, there is just this flurry of activity.
Lead study author Dr. Jeremy Faust is an emergency physician and professor at Harvard Medical School.
You will have states like Alabama or Louisiana and Texas that are enacting much more aggressive laws in terms of freedom of access, freedom of carry, concealed carry in churches, laws about stand your ground.
Other states like California tighten their firearm laws.
Things like safety training requirements or places instituted waiting periods or background checks to make sure that they didn't have a violent criminal offense in their recent past.
Faust and his team grouped states into three buckets based on their gun laws: most permissive, permissive, and least permissive. Then they looked at the overall pediatric firearm deaths in the three groups from 2011 to 2023 compared to the decade before.
In the most permissive states, it's a 67% relative increase.
In the second group, the permissive states, there was a 52% rise in pediatric deaths.
On one hand, you have 7,400 more deaths than should have happened in these states that have loosened their gun laws. That's over 500 per year. These are not deaths that should have occurred. They are preventable.
Meanwhile, the states with tougher gun regulations did not see a rise in deaths.
What it's showing is that states that have overall stricter gun laws, we are not seeing the same increases of death as states that have permissive gun laws.
Dr. Maya Haas is an emergency physician and researcher at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She wasn't involved in the new study and says its findings show there's a path to keeping kids safe from gun violence.
This doesn't mean we should change all our laws at once, but it says perhaps if we could look at these laws and see which ones are effective, then we could start moving towards safety.
Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
For the first time, a Chinese fighter plane made a debut in an active conflict.
PAF's Wigris Dragon is here.
Pakistani pilots manned the Chinese J-10C during 4 days of clashes against India in May. And the consequences of that debut may be far-reaching. NPR's Dia Hadid has more from Mumbai, and her story includes reporting from NPR's Emily Feng in Washington.
The Chinese fighter jets made an appearance after India launched strikes on Pakistan in May. India says it was retaliation for an attack 2 weeks earlier, where militants killed 26 people. Pakistan said it wasn't connected, and it fought back. It was the most serious fighting in decades. One piece of hardware that Pakistan used commanded outsized attention: the Chengdu J-10C Vigorous Dragon, or the J-10. It's in the league of the F-16 or the French Rafale. That fighter jet is used by militaries around the world, including India's. And soon after fighting began, Pakistan claimed that their J-10 squadron downed three of those French-made Rafales. CNN and Reuters later reported that Pakistan likely downed one Rafale. Only weeks later, the Indian Chief of Defence Staff confirmed that they lost aircraft, but gave no further details. But the debut of the J-10 was not lost on those watching this conflict.
The old commercial used to say, you know, this ain't your daddy's Oldsmobile.
Brendan Mulvaney is a director of the U.S. Department of the Air Force's China Aerospace Studies Institute.
The Indians were flying a very modern, very capable aircraft. The Pakistanis were flying a Chinese aircraft and shot it down with a Chinese air-to-air missile.
Chinese social media went wild. This clip went viral. Chinese men dance Bollywood style with toy airplanes stuck to their Indian turbans and taunt to an Indian tune. They sing, "What a shame, those planes were destroyed." The planes were the most prominent kit, but so much more comes from China. Aisha Siddiqua is an expert on Pakistan's military.
By the time we got into this round of conflict, Pakistan's weaponry, 72 to 80%, has been from China.
That gave the appearance to many Indians that China was ganging up with Pakistan. India and China have long-standing border disputes. This is retired Indian Major General Ashok Kumar.
Pakistan used the entire weaponry provided by China. So indirectly, it became a fight with China.
He says that's what made the four-day conflict in May far more serious than previous bouts of fighting between India and Pakistan. But one analyst argues China isn't seeking to be a partner in Pakistan's fight with India. This is Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Albany, Christopher Clary.
China has been hesitant to take a public role other than voicing support for Pakistan and encouraging restraint.
But Clary says China will keep weapons flowing for Pakistan for its next fight with India.
What seems to be changing about modern China is it has the military capabilities to be a partner that can keep another state like Pakistan in a fight.
And the next fight is likely to be far more severe because the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has vowed to hit Pakistan even harder next time.
With Indian officials saying publicly that terrorism on Indian soil will be greeted by a military response, it is reasonable to expect that the next crisis will be quite severe.
But not everything China supplied Pakistan was top-notch. Pakistan's Chinese-supplied air defences appear to have largely failed during the fighting. India struck deep into Pakistan multiple times, including a military base near the capital. Mulvaney of the China Aerospace Studies Institute says, regardless,
we should give it due respect. They're not quite as good as, you know, what the U.S. and our allies and partners use, but they're pretty darn good. They don't need as cool as Gucci equipment.
Good enough. And that may be enough in the next round of fighting. With Emily Feng in Washington, I'm Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hold.
All my boyfriends have gone away, but there's one fella who is here to stay. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. He's a 4F papa, and he's been that way for years. He's too old for the army, too cold for the navy, staying home trying to sop up all the gravy. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. Every single day he's out on the hunt. He'd like to do some fighting on any old front. The girls say no, no, he's got no vim. It's better to do without.